a shorter turn around any magnetic structure can drastically lower the inductance and give you phase shift if you're smart enough to know how to do it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Thank you, Hal.
KC2WGB, very good. Now, his last question on the subject is, do you think it makes any difference where he puts it on the antenna as far as the length? At the high current point or the high voltage point, do you think that would change anything that he hasn't experimented with yet?
Oh, absolutely. Just to give you a simpler example, if I started off with a quarter wave ground plane antenna, vertically polarized, and I start shortening the radiator section, which started off a quarter wave, and I start making it shorter, the antenna now goes up in frequency of resonance, let's call it, or conversely, the impedance that I measure at the bottom starts becoming highly capacitive real fast as I shorten it. If I put a loading coil at the bottom, which is now a series inductance, canceling the series capacitance of the radiators too short, I can bring it back into resonance. As I move that coil along the radiator, move it further and further away from the bottom, the amount of coil that I need going to change. And a couple of complicated things are going on here. In general, I think the amount of coil, the number of turns of the coil, the requirement to bring it back to resonance is going to increase as you move it, because in the case of a quarter wave ground plane resonator, ordinarily there's a lot of current flowing at the bottom, no current flowing at the top. So where you put, where you put your so-called loading coil, whether it's in the high current area or the low current area, makes a rather big difference. As you move that coil further and further up the radiator, and now you put it at the very top, where there is no wire beyond the coil, you think you've put in an inductor. All you've really done is you've created a lump of metallic material that's now a top-loading capacitor. So believe it or not, your coil, if you kept the same number of turns, and by some magic, you could move it along that wire. It's an inductor at the bottom. It becomes less inductance in the middle, and as you move it all the way to the top, it becomes a top hat capacitor. So, will the position of the coil make a difference? Yea, verily. Is there a most desirable position? Probably, depending on what you're trying to do. It's another experimenter's paradise. You've now got a lot of tinkering you can do. How many times does a piece of wire go through the toroid? How many turns? When you twist it, how many twists? And where is it located? Got a lot of variables to play with here. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, very good. Then he should realize that inductance will have its maximum effect at the high current point. As he moves to the high voltage point of the antenna, it'll become more of a capacitor effect rather than an inductor. Is that correct?
In general, the answer is yes, John. You've got the concept. So, he will get very different performance depending on where along the wire he puts it. In the case of a piece of wire that's 80 feet long, if he was using it on 80 meters, he's always under a quarter wavelength long. He's going to get the maximum performance of the circuit when it's near the fed end, I believe. Yes, I think so. If he's using it on 40 meters, an 80-foot piece of wire on 40 meters is more than a half wave long, 67 feet. So now, he's now going to get two locations along the wire at two of the high current points, so to speak, or two of the high voltage points in which he gets a particular performance. In other words, if he slowly plotted the performance versus position, he's going to find out that there's two positions that give you essentially the same characteristic, because this wire is more than halfway long. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, I'll tell you, some of these hardworking amateurs, they really come up with some crafty little projects, and they're like doing it in their basement. Sneaky. But I love the questions. All right, I think Paul's got a ton of information for us this week, so let's go over to Paul, and that's it from the mailbag. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, WS2N is our space expert, about to give us a space report number 158 of the series. Did anything interesting happen this week, Paul? Something called New Horizons went whizzing by Pluto at something close to 30,000 miles an hour. And so it was in the near vicinity of Pluto for a good fraction of an hour, snapping pictures like a real good tourist. Millions of pictures being snapped. And during that picture snapping period, I believe it didn't waste its time aiming the antenna toward Earth and giving us live reports, other than some telemetry information saying that, yes, the voltage is correct. But it isn't until it was through with the flyby of taking pictures of Pluto and of its moons, its five moons, then it started very slowly mailing the information back home at something like 600 bits or 1,000 bits per second, which is the maximum speed it could use with that particular antenna and that particular 12 watts of power output from that particular traveling wave tube. And when you go to one of the NASA sites, let me drop this. You'll find out that each of the NASA sites at Goldstone, California, Madrid, Spain, and near Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, but it's not exactly where it is. I keep forgetting the name of the place. At each of those sites, NASA has a 240-foot dish, a 150-foot dish, a 90-foot dish, a 35-foot dish. They got a whole bunch of dishes. And I did see, when I looked at the particular NASA site, which tells you what each of the sites are doing, they did show you that they were getting downlink real data at that instant of time when I looked last night from New Horizons. And it wasn't on the big dish. It was one of the smaller dishes. The big dish was, at that instant, a book solid doing something else. So they readjust the data rate and use whatever dish is left over at the time, so to speak. And one of the questions asked earlier, do they combine those dishes simultaneously? In other words, with the Earth in the right orientation, let me drop this, with the right in orientation of the Earth such that Madrid, Spain, and Redstone, California can see Pluto simultaneously. Did they ever use both dishes at the same time? The answer is primarily no. They could do that, but there's a whole lot of complicated reasons as to why it's quite difficult. So most of the time, one particular location on those three places on the Earth, 120 degrees apart, one location at a time, not necessarily always a big dish, is doing the listening. And do they combine them as very long baseline interferometry to listen to the downlink signal? They could do that. The amount of improvement versus the degree of difficulty makes it not very likely. Over to you, Paul. That's my assessment of that. WS2N, I'd like to hear what New Horizons is doing. KQRIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, we've been following the Pluto story, I don't know, well before launch. So, 1989, they thought about doing this, and they called it Pluto Express. That was what it was going to be, but that all changed. They mothballed it, and they brought it back to life on the New Horizon as the years went by. But very interesting information you gave, Dick, early in the net, and just now. The space network is active, but they have to share the time between other missions like the Cassini coming back to Saturn and a lot of the ones in orbital orbits around the sun. You have the stereo spacecraft and sending information back, and you've got shared time with all the spacecraft we have on Mars. Let me drop it. They can't continually transmit. Actually, they can't, they'll run out of power anyway. They have to give it a break and let the RTGs recharge batteries. You can only operate and transmit so long on New Horizon. They have seven instruments on board, and even now they're still taking new data as they go further away from Pluto. And interesting, they have a countdown clock on the going on the app that I use, the Pluto Safari Act. The app has had a countdown all the way down to zero during a flyby, and now it says how many miles it is away from Pluto. So that's always fun to look at. They had the animations in 3D where everything is at this time. It's a very good app. If anybody has a nice little tablet or even your phone, smartphones, you can download the Pluto Safari for free. Drop it. Now, I just wanted to take 2.5 minutes and play something, which I thought was interesting, that I watched live. It was on the NASA broadcast on the 14th when spacecraft radioed back home at 8:52 p.m. So I just thought I'd play. It would take about 2.5 minutes, Dick. Do you mind?
Go right ahead, Paul. You may have to interrupt it at a minute and 3/4 to make sure you don't time out the machine. Over to you, Paul.
I planned that. I jotted that down so I don't forget. All right, here we go. This is from Alice Bowman. She's in charge of the whole... You're going to hear seven reports.
Please report your status as you get enough data.
And the subsystems will report your status.
Mom, this is RF on Pluto 1.
Go ahead, RF.
RF is reporting nominal carrier power, nominal symbol of noise ratio, and the telemetry. RF is nominal.
Copy that. RF nominal.
Mom, is autonomy on Pluto 1?
Go ahead, autonomy.
Autonomy is very happy to report nominal status. No rules have fired.
Woman, she started out, 10 years ago. She's the first you notice they call her Mom. That's M-O-M, that's for Mission Operation Manager. Each time I went back to her, and she does the report. Now, this went on for years. You know, they would, you know, when they did a systems check, they would do this type of thing. But this was the main final one. And they went through the 7 different subsystems. And the first one you heard was RF, and they did the data recording. They knew at that point that all the memory was loaded. I mean, they got gigabytes, I think like 50 gigabytes of stuff that's got to come back. And I think there's something like 1 gigabyte that came back so far. So they've got, you know, over a year, like 16 months to get this information back. You heard propulsion, hydrazine systems, plenty of stuff on board. Everything's pressurized to the proper numbers. You have power, the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator, that's up and running. They gave thermal, you know, temperatures throughout the spacecraft. And by doing that, you realize this thing really is a robot out there. I mean, it's autonomous. It was flying to Pluto. It knew at a certain time, without any further correspondence with Earth, to turn its spacecraft, turn the antenna away from the from Earth. It had no articulating motors that you could turn a camera one way or the other. The whole spacecraft turned and had to face toward Pluto and a different planet, Charon, and then start taking pictures and running the 7 different instruments. You had the Alice and the Ralph, and then Alice was the ultraviolet spectrometer, and the Ralph was the infrared spectrometer. All these things had to start doing its work at a certain time, and to load this thing up with data. And now it's sitting out there, going further away from Pluto, sending it back to Earth. I think it's a phenomenal job by all these engineers, people that operate the spacecraft, playing on this stuff. Let me drop it. Of course, you know, I can't show you pictures here. You've probably seen them on the TV or on the computer. I don't know if anybody buys newspapers anymore, but, you know, the pictures that came back are amazing, considering you had pixels worth of what Pluto used to look like from the Hubble Space Telescope to detail now. When they show a detail of Pluto, they'll zoom down into the part of the heart there. Big heart on Pluto. They'll just take a little piece of that, and that's roughly 125-130 miles long. So you know, when you look at those little rectangles and the details of the 11,000 foot mountains, you know, that little detail is about the length of Long Island. So and then they say it's even going to be more detailed as time goes on. Computers have changed some of the pictures into what looks like a flyover, you know, a real-time flyover on part of the planet. Got the pictures of Charon. They now know that it's an active moon. There's not hardly any craters on there, what they thought you would normally see, like our moon. It's got a lot of flat areas that lets them know that it's geologically active over the last, you know, billion years or so. Even maybe up until the present day. They're looking for geysers, possible geysers that might be coming out of Pluto, similar to what they saw on Triton when Voyager went by. They haven't seen anything like that yet. Kind of behind the planet that's going away, and they've looked back with Rex is what they call their antenna system. So they look back at the sun. When they're behind the planet, and the sun, they're using the sun's light going through the atmosphere to pick up the components of Pluto. They know now it's composed of mainly nitrogen and carbon dioxide, Bob, you know, other chemicals, methane. They're able to see this on their spectrometers. I think it's an amazing achievement. I think it's some $700 million that put up for this I had to play that, Dick, so any questions or anything about that part of it before I continue? This Alice Bowman was fantastic. And then she, at the end, she turned it over to the PI, that's principal investigator, that's Alan Stern. He has been around for 27 years pushing this project. So he's in charge of the science end of it. He comes out of Boulder, Colorado. And this all took place in Mission Control, actually, for this is in Maryland, the Applied Physics Laboratory. Back to you, Dick, for any questions. And we have other space topics that we have to cover, but of course, this is number one.
In the case of the solid state recorder on board, where 50 gigabytes was probably recorded, it sounds like the right number. I am guessing, Paul, they have downloaded about a megabyte so far. You said a gigabyte. I know that the downlink data rate is somewhere between 600 bits per second and 1 kilobit per second. And if you're downloading a gigabyte at that rate, it would take 277 hours. That would be 11.5 days. I know that they didn't do that. So I'm guessing a little over a megabyte has been downloaded so far, which is a fraction of an hour. That makes a lot more sense. But it's going to take, I think the prediction is something as much as 16 months to download all of the 50 gigabytes that they've got so far. And so what I think they've done is to choose a couple of samples of the data, telemetry data, the picture of Pluto, a little chunk of it. Doesn't show you the whole great big picture, just a nice little section that's got those mountains that are 10,000 foot high. And they believe they are ice mountains, not necessarily rock mountains. And so we're getting little teases of the various projects on board, giving us that downlink.
Quick question, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Are you sure that's gigabytes, not terabytes?
I'm going to guess that the total data recording is around 50 gigabytes. Paul's going to give us a correction on that. And so 1 gigabyte takes 277 hours to downlink, if you can do it at 1 kilobit per second. And I think there are times when they've got to do it at 600 bits per second. So we can work out the mathematics as to how long it's going to take. On top of that, the 16 months of total downlink time is based on the fact that the signal is not being sent 24/7. I think there's some interruptions when the downlink, when the base stations, when the ground stations have to be doing other functions. Let's see what Paul can say about that. WS2N, K2LAW.
Question, W2HO.
Paul first, and then we'll go over to W2HO.
I listen to the principal investigator, Alan Stern, anytime he gets on. I always listen, and he did say 50 gigabytes, and from the beginning, you know, received transmissions are less than 1 gigabyte, and he was going to check on that when the question was asked, and that includes a lot of stuff before they actually get there, so he's got total time transmissions. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was a lot less than that, but he was going to check on it. He did say less than one gigabyte. He had a question there.
Listen, the person who signed in is W2HO, which is the Orange County Amateur Radio Association, I think it is. Give us your name, sir, and then go right ahead with your question. K2RIW.
HL, Henry. Hate lines. Howard. Yeah, I understand that. New Horizons, I understand, is also transmitting, I believe it. I think I heard 10 watts, which is amazing. I just want to know, Paul, I'm just curious to know what is happening. Where is New Horizons going to go after this? I mean, it's going to go to, I wonder how long it's going to take to reach the solar system. Will it be sending back any sort of data? I know this thing was kept dormant until they woke her up, but I was just wondering where it goes from here. Is it going into lower space, and will it be capable of transmitting back? And I understand Voyager has already reached the stellar space, and if that is sending anything back,
This is WS2N. You have New Horizon right now is at roughly 30 AU. The average distance of Pluto is around 39. So you know, it's interesting that you know if we come back 50 years from now, it would be a lot harder to do because Pluto would be further away. At its furthest distance, it's 5 billion miles away, and it's not quite at its closest distance, but a little further away than its closest distance, which is 3 billion miles. So now New Horizon is on a path into the Kuiper Belt, and it will be looking for, they have two objects they're thinking about. They've actually searched with a Hubble Space Telescope to figure out where they could go. You know, there's got to be something out there. There's thousands of these objects that are around the Kuiper Belt. So they found two that they're thinking about. So even if they pick up one, they'll be happy about it. But that won't be for many years from now. And I was waiting for somebody to ask that question at one of the news conferences. Drop it. Sure enough, they had in the back of the auditorium, they had these kids. They called them the Pluto kids. The reason they called them the Pluto kids, they were born on January 19th. I think it's the thing took off. January 19th. You made a statement earlier. I forgot the exact date, but that rings a bell. But it was 2006. So anybody was born on that date, some of the people brought these kids in, and here they are, almost 10 years old. And one of the girls got, somebody has a question. One of the girls asked a question about the extended mission, and Alan started to answer the question. He did say it'll be going into the Kuiper Belt, and they'll be looking for science out there. So they'll do something with it. They got plenty of fuel. Plenty of power. 12 watts is the number I heard for the transmitter. And two traveling wave tubes. I think that last week, how that's all connected. But 12 watts is pretty good to pick up by the Deep Space Network. Let me drop it.
Question, Dick.
It has about the same amount of power probably now. I think at one point they were around 23 watts for transmitting on the Voyages. Their power is getting reduced as time goes on, not because of the distance, but because the power of the whole system transmitting is dropping little by little. They lose around 4% overall power from the RTGs per year, so they keep cutting back on things. That's why some of the things, if you would try to turn the camera back on Voyager, something was coming up that wouldn't work. So same thing happened with New Horizon. They expect it to go at 2046-48. They expect to possibly be hearing from that spacecraft as it goes on its way. Right now it's only at 30-some-odd AU. In years past, it'll be out to eventually 100 AU. And that won't even be as close to where the Voyages are now. They're 107 and I think 131 respectively. Back to you, I guess, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N.
Yeah, John has a further question. And I think you told us last week or the week before, because Voyager used the gravity assist of multiple planets, I think it flew by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, I think it had about two or three gravity assists by a slingshot flyby. Therefore, right now, Voyager, I believe, is at a higher velocity than New Horizons. New Horizons was the fastest launch we've ever made in miles per hour as it left Earth, but it only had one gravity assist from Jupiter. And as such, I think you told us that New Horizons will never catch up with Voyager. Voyager will always be at a slightly larger speed, velocity, and that one or two of those Kuiper Belt objects, which Pluto got downgraded from a planet to a minor planetesimal or whatever, minor planet, simply because they thought they were finding larger objects in the Kuiper Belt, and therefore the number of total planets on the solar system would start climbing to very high numbers, and the astrophysicists didn't want to do that. Well, now that we've flown by Pluto, found that the Pluto is a little bit larger than they thought. It still is the largest object we know of in the Kuiper Belt, but it's not the heaviest object in the Kuiper Belt. Therefore, even though some people want to reinstate Pluto as a planet, most likely that's not going to happen. Oh well, poor old Pluto. He probably doesn't really care what we call him, as long as we give him this much emphasis and take his photographs as we go whizzing by. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, maybe because it's not on the ecliptic like the rest of them, they won't consider it a planet at all. But I have a question. If we find out if it has a magnetic field yet, does that information come down? Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, another reason why Pluto is not considered a planet is because its orbit is so tilted and so elliptical that for something like 10% of its orbit, it goes inside of the orbit of Neptune. So it hasn't thoroughly cleared out its area of orbit, even though it meets the other criteria of a planet, meaning a round object with moons of its own. But its orbit is a little bit too elliptical, and it goes inside of somebody else's orbit, hasn't cleared out its area, and therefore no go. But let's see, I'm going to answer John's question, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, John, I haven't heard anything about the magnetic field yet, but I'm sure that data will come in. We'll see. You're talking about whether or not this thing's a planet or not. Well, hasn't cleared out the moon. Hasn't cleared out the area. Part of Neptune's orbit goes slightly into the Kuiper Belt. If you cross Neptune off the list, well, I can think of it like this. You know, they found out that Pluto has now five moons, so it's not clearing out the neighborhood, it's collecting the neighborhood. And now it's got a tail, so Pluto, just like the Pluto dog from Disneyland, this thing's got a tail, and what it is electrons that are being stripped off of the planet and going behind the planet. In fact, New Horizons flew through this tail, and it extends, they think now, 48,000 miles from the planet. So this really an extension of its atmosphere. If you want to consider that, you know, the nitrogen is being, whatever chemicals are on the planet are being stripped off. They said it was nitrogen. You know, nitrogen's pretty inert, so somehow these electrons are flying off the nitrogen and becoming an ion and winding up behind the planet. They know that now because they have out of the seven instruments on board the spacecraft, they have detected that. So I'm going to say it has a tail. It's got to be a planet. they'll be talking about that argument for years. When it took off, 2006, it was still a planet. So as far as that robot is concerned, flying out there 3 billion miles from here, the robot thinks it's still a planet. And they keep calling it a dwarf planet. That's the name, you know. Planetismals are supposed to be things that never became a planet, you know, like proto-planets. But this thing is called a dwarf planet, so they keep calling it a dwarf planet. And when you listen to the interviews, Alan Stern and the rest of the people being interviewed, they refer to it as a planet. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens. Like you said, NASA could rewrite the dictionary with nominal. Well, maybe they'll rewrite the dictionary with planet. Back to you, Dick.
But you guys do see the last Tuesday science section of the New York Times, July 14th, Tuesday, page 821. The article is called Pluto Comes in Focus. One of the interesting experiments that was done 30 June of this year was a group of scientists went to New Zealand where there was a major telescope, and the reason they chose that major telescope in New Zealand because Pluto was about to be occulting a star, and the shadow of Pluto, which is 1,500 miles wide, was sweeping across New Zealand, and as it did, as Pluto comes in front of that star, if Pluto had no atmosphere, then the star would wink out in a fraction of a millisecond. As Pluto got in front of the star, because the star is a point source of light billions of miles away, essentially at infinity, many light years away. And when they looked at that picture, Pluto swished through that star in a 2-minute period of time. And by the way, you calculate that at the rate at which Pluto is moving, it should have been a much longer period of time. What was happening is that the Earth's movement at the same time is what made the shadow move very fast across the Earth. So during that 2-minute period of time, the atmosphere of Pluto very slowly winked out that star, and then when Pluto came back in front of, away from the star, the star light came back on again. So, in other words, as of June 30, we knew something about the thickness of the atmosphere of Pluto by way of that June 30 experiment in New Zealand. And now when New Horizons, let me drop this. When New Horizons zipped behind Pluto and looked at the sun being occulted, I am guessing that the spectrometers on board were measuring the individual lines of suckout of the Pluto atmosphere of the solar radiation. Therefore, you can recognize individual elements in that atmosphere. I am guessing that took place. Don't know if that data has been downloaded yet. On top of that, one of the articles I read is estimating that Pluto is outgassing an awful lot of its atmosphere. It probably doesn't have much of a magnetic field. The solar wind is peeling away atmosphere from Pluto, and I think they estimate how many tons per hour of atmosphere of Pluto are being lost to space. And so the material that they're measuring on the surface of Pluto and in its atmosphere, I'm leading them to believe that a lot of stuff must be upwelling from deeper within the Pluto ground, so to speak, because everything on the surface would have been gone by now. The whole atmosphere would have been gone by now if that wasn't happening. You probably know more about that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
That's on planet surface is ice at one time. But they say it was 30 feet thick or something. 30 feet of it. I don't know how thick it is now, but 30 feet of it. If you pull them up, that is boiled off or turned into a plasma state 3-4 billion years ago when it started, and it's still doing it now. And they did look into that with instruments on board. Looking back at the sun, the planet was occulting the sun. They used the Alice detector, the infrared spectrometer, when they were looking back. And also the Rex, they actually received the signal from the sun through the antenna some way. They're using that, and they're able to figure this out. And the data was sent back, so they know what the atmosphere is made out of. But there's more data to come back. I mean, it's only preliminary. All these things are, you know, pictures, the information from each machine, each detector. All preliminary. They need to do this in case something quit. They need something. So like Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, the first thing they did is pick up a rocket and he put it into a side pocket on the side of his thigh in case something went wrong real quick and he had to get back into the LEM. He would have bought something back. Let me drop it. So, there's a lot more that's going to come out in a year or over a year that the information is going to come back. Right now they're going to have news conferences roughly every week. You know what's going to happen. It's going to stretch out longer and longer. But the information will continue to come back on computers, NASA.gov. And I wanted to tell Eric, too, out there that I asked him about whether or not PBS was going to have a show about this, and sure enough, NOVA did have a show chasing Pluto, and I watched the other ones too. On the Science Channel had one, and on National Geographic, we dropped it. And naturally, by far, NOVA on PBS blew them away. And I don't know if you saw it, Dick, but they had the speed of the spacecraft leaving Earth. It was 38,000 miles
1,000 miles per hour, and that was one of the questions that I think you had either last week or the week before, and I didn't know the exact number. We were trying to figure out what it was. Sure enough, they came out with that on that program, along with a lot of other information. Very well done. So, all right, there, guy. If you want to move on, I have a couple other space science topics.
I think we should stick with New Horizons for a little bit longer, Paul. The solar system, as we know it, is believed to be roughly 4.5 billion years old. Every single object in our solar system has been hit with all kinds of meteors, meteorites, I can't even think of the name of the other, asteroids, all kinds of, Meteor Crater in Arizona shows you a great big hole in the ground where the Earth got hit. There's a huge hole underwater in the Yucatan Peninsula. Mars shows great big pockmarks of being bombarded for billions of years. Mercury shows great big pockmarks of being bombarded. One of the things that was done by Hubble Space Telescope is to watch that comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 plow into Jupiter and leave great big black marks. So everything in the solar system has been hit by various objects from space that create craters. They were absolutely positive that when they saw Pluto, they're going to see great big craters. Not a single crater on Pluto. Right now, this got them confused. Let me drop the... Now, you could say there's a whole lot of geological activity, geysers or volcanoes or whatever, smoothing out the surface of Pluto. Pluto is believed to be 4.5 billion years with us in this solar system, and not a single pockmark on it. And I think that's a great big question mark. Maybe the ice on the surface has somehow smoothed it all over, but when you got things that are that cold, how in the world can the craters go away? Do you have an explanation for why there's no craters on Pluto and no craters on Charon? How did its moon and its planet, what used to be called planet, not get hit when everything else in the solar system gets hit? WS2N, K2RAW, the TechNet.
I have a comment also, Dick.
No, I don't know. I'm still waiting for the reports from APL. See what they say. But the ice, if it's water ice, at those temperatures, minus 360 some odd degrees, they say it's like concrete. The ice is not the same kind of ice that we have on our refrigerator. It's literally, you couldn't cut through it. And probably the same thing holds true for the nitrogen. And John wanted to say something, so let him go.
Go right ahead, John.
EC2WGB. Well, Dick, if you think about it, if you look at the inclinations of the ecliptic that Pluto has, it may have been outside of the thickness of the accretion disk, or maybe it was captured later. So, being that it's small, has much less gravitational attraction, maybe that's some of the reason it hasn't attracted, plus it's outside of the accretion disk for such a long period of time. Those may be some of the reasons.
Yeah, that's possible. But for anything to be anywhere near our solar system, where the sun is a huge attractor, and for all kinds of comets and asteroids and every other piece of space junk is being attracted to the sun, and on its way toward the sun, it's going to hit everything in between. If Pluto was anywhere near our vicinity, where the sun is such a big attractor, it should have been hit. Minus 360 degrees Fahrenheit, if that's the number, Paul. When you start getting numbers that cold, I'd rather think about them in degrees Kelvin. That's 55 Kelvins, which is considerably colder than liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen is 77 Kelvins. So that's a cool place. So any other speculations as to why Pluto is completely unscathed? Either it has never been hit, I don't believe it, or something has been smoothing over that surface. And maybe the ice on the surface has somehow been doing that. WS2N, K2RAW.
Why they're calling them both active. They're both, including the moon, active, geologically active. So I know that they definitely theorize. I mean, it sounds like they really believe in the possibility that as Pluto goes around the sun, it does have a winter and a summer, although it's 248 years old to go all the way around. One time around the merry-go-round, that's, you know, it does have a, and it's tilted on its side, you know, for you to look at it, it was a little like a bullseye, and that's why when this spacecraft went through, it was like going through a bullseye instead of, you know, coming to the first moon or the second moon or the third moon, eventually to the Pluto, Pluto. I mean, it came right in, and they used the ring of Charon to go through. I know I mentioned it last week, and they know that if Charon's going around, if there's any debris, pebbles, or small grains of something, it probably wouldn't be there because Charon has cleared the way, and they adjusted their orbit to go to that point. If anything hit the spacecraft at 31,000 miles an hour as it was going through, it could be toast for the spacecraft. So, looking at the planet, they think there's snow, nitrogen snow. So, see, I'm calling it a planet, but I listen to these press conferences. But you look at Pluto, and they say as it goes around, the atmosphere does tend to boil off a little bit, the nitrogen. And then as it goes into its winter, it'll start condensing and going back down to the surface. And this could be one explanation for Pluto, but apparently not Charon. I'm not sure what the reasoning is for that. I don't think it has the kind of atmosphere that Pluto does. Back to you.
Pluto does have an average distance from the sun of 39 astronomical units. Astronomical unit is the average distance of Earth from the sun, roughly 93 million miles. So one of the interesting pieces of mathematics is if on any planet you know the number of astronomical units that planet is away from the sun, raise that number of astronomical units to the power of 1.5, and now know the period. You take 39, the number of astronomical units of Pluto, raise it to the 1.5 power, you get 243.5 years. That's very close to the period of Pluto going around the sun. And so anything you know the astronomical unit of, you raise it to the 1.5 power. And you can use that in reverse. If somebody tells you the period of Jupiter, and you do the opposite, raise it to the power of 1 over 1.5, 0.6666, and you know the number of astronomical units. So if somebody tells you a period, you raise it to the 0.666 power, and you know the astronomical units. Conversely, somebody tells you astronomical units, raise it to the 1.5 power, you know how long it takes to make one orbit. And so that's Kepler's second law. I think that's Kepler's second law. You know, first law, I think, is everything is an ellipse. Second law is period versus distance. And third law is equal area, equal time. Sweeping. I think I've got them maybe in reverse order, but those are the Kepler three laws. So that's kind of a handy one to work out mathematically. Modern-day handheld calculators usually can raise things to the exponential power. And with any further questions about what we've covered so far tonight, give me your call, letters, and name right now. K2RIW, the Tech National.
See, the information that was it Mike that you know, he sent to us about the spacecraft, the location of the antennas, I thought that was pretty interesting there.
Yeah, what Paul was referring to is Mike number 2, K1, K1YH, what's his call letters, Mike? I mean, Paul, what's Mike's call letters?
K1 MJM.
That's the guy. He sent Paul and me and maybe some other people this beautiful article giving you a lot of technical details about the transmitters, receivers, schematic diagrams, functional block diagrams, numbers, and everything else about New Horizons. From which I found out New Horizons is a slightly more complicated radio system than the rest of the Deep Space Network satellites. From that I found out that the downlink is something like 8.1 gigs and the uplink is something like 7.4 gigs. To that 2.1 foot dish. So we know the size of the dish, we know the amount of gain, we can calculate, we know the frequencies, we know the way everything works as far as ranging and the way it transmits data. And there was an article in there saying that there was a brief experiment with New Horizons using both traveling wave tubes, 12 watts output each, using both traveling wave tubes simultaneously. One goes into a horn that feeds a clockwise signal into the dish. The other one goes into a horn that feeds a counterclockwise, circular, polarized signal into the dish. You send both of those signals down to Goldstone, and then Goldstone will demodulate those two signals simultaneously. If everything was perfect, they would have gotten a 3 dB increase in power. They did measure 2.7 dB of increase in power when both TWTs are running simultaneously. So they do have the ability of transmitting both traveling wave tubes at the same time in order to double the data rate. Now, whether or not they've got the power on board to do that, and in order to have the power to do that, they have to turn off other experiments is a choice they've got to make. Are they in a hurry to get the data by doubling the speed, or are they willing to spend the 16 months? That's what we're about to find out. So I wonder if you've seen that section of that particular article. Very well done article. And I am predicting that Mike number two is going to put that on his website. I don't think it's there yet. WS2N, K2RIW.
Very good. Yeah, I was reading through it. I thought it was great. And I got to that section. I said, oh, man, Dick is going to love this part. I couldn't believe it. This is stuff we've talked about for months here. Not only that, years, because we talk about the traveling wave tubes, especially with Voyager and all of that. So, very good. Very good. And so, all right. If you don't have anything else, Dick, I'll just want to make a quick statement for on the 22nd, they're going to have another launch up to the International Space Station. Three more people are going up to join the three that are up there. So I do want to make that statement. You do have three on board. They had to get into a Soyuz spacecraft and sit there for a while and wait for a piece of space junk from Media 2, an old Russian spacecraft launched in 1979. They had to get out of the way, but just in case it hit, they need to be in the spacecraft in case the whole station blows up or something to get away. That was pretty interesting. Let me drop it. They should have their contingency of six people up on board by probably the 24th. Then they're not going to make a direct shot like they have been. It's going to take a couple of days. On board the space station, they have a slow scan TV operating probably at this time. It started a couple few days ago, and John from Jersey, I guess called here, where he sent me information about that, and there was information on Newsline about it, and what it is slow scan TV. What they're doing is celebrating the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the Soyuz Apollo joint mission that happened back in it was last Apollo mission back in 75 when we dropped it. After that, you had a 6-year dry situation for the United States like we have now, with no launches all the way to the space shuttle. But John sent me a good picture of what they were getting for slow scan TV and information regarding that. And in fact, some audio too. One of the Russians talking. That was all coming down on 2 meters, 145, 800, I think it is. That's pretty much it. Going back to New Horizon, I'm fine with that too. Dick. Back to you, K2RIW, WS2N.
One of the Progress ships did not dock properly with the International Space Station a couple of months ago, and therefore an awful lot of cargo consumables didn't get delivered. Was there a replacement cargo ship in that period of time since then to now? If we're about to launch three more astronauts, probably from Kazakhstan on a Soyuz, and now you're going to go to six people on board. If the six people are on board and you haven't yet had the replacement of the missing consumables, that sounds like we're pushing our luck a little bit. So give me some words on that, Paul. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that worked out about a week or so ago. They sent a progress up with the old configuration. They think something is wrong with the new configuration. Progress, the way it's attached to the Soyuz spacecraft. I guess they're going to work that out and find out what's wrong with it. And that was back in April. Separated and wound up spinning wildly in space. They knew that because the pictures were coming back, video pictures, 14 revolutions per minute, and then eventually it failed and then deorbited. So before sending people up, they wanted to make sure they, it goes up on a similar craft, the Soyuz spacecraft, launches people and cargo. So that's all been pretty much worked out. The new configuration has been done away with temporarily. I think they're going to try to bring it back. Russians have had some problems with their heavy lift vehicle too, the Proton rocket. So everybody's got their problems. We have our problems with the Falcon 9. We have our problems with the Orbital Science Antares launch that blew up last October. But it's going to be Cygnus launch at the end of the year. I think they're pushing that up to October because they are low on supplies, like you said. The launch should go up. It's not going to go up, from Wallops. They made a deal with the United Space Alliance, the Boeing and Lockheed, who launched the Deltas and the Atlas rockets, and they made a deal to put a Cygnus cargo vehicle on top of an Atlas rocket, and they'll launch that probably in October, maybe, to the space station to restock the space station. And plus, you have another one launching out of Japan, an H-2 cargo spacecraft that's going to be launched out of Japan shortly. Help restock it. I think that's in August sometime. Back to you, Dick.
So it sounds like there isn't a shortage of consumables on board. That's good news. Anybody got any further questions for Paul? If not, I'll go back to a previous subject that we were discussing. But we're still in the space report portion where we discussed the International Space Station, the New Horizons, my favorite vehicle, the Voyager, out there at 131 astronomical units, something like 37 hours round-trip time radio distance. Oh, boy, is that down the road a piece.
I have a question, Dick.
You got it, John.
AC2WGB. Dick, could Paul give us an update on the Mars rovers, what's going on with them, and how many are working, and what are they doing? I haven't heard anything on that in a while.
Yeah, the original ones were Spirit and Opportunity. One of them, I think, is movable. And the new one, the newest one, the size of a Volkswagen, is a Curiosity. And I think it has had a minor wheel failure. I think it went over some sharp rocks, and I think the wheel got a little bit damaged. So tell us what's going on the surface of Mars, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, I hate to have that wheel damage on Curiosity. You know, they have on all their wheels, they have JPL and CW, you know, they have holes in the wheels, and they have, dots, little hole, long dash hole, and it's a practical purpose when they drive on a planet, they look